floodgates. It's time to welcome the river. The river of life.
You are listening to the Go Health Podcast. The Go Health Podcast seeks to explore stories, how people have found healing, and how we can learn from them, from their stories of human flourishing, some ordinary, some extraordinary. I'm Gillian Strain, and I run the Guild of Health and St. Raphael. In this episode of the Go Health Podcast, I am chatting with Professor John Stackhouse. He is a Canadian theologian, author, journalist, and academic, and currently is the Professor of Religious Studies at Crandall University in Canada. Professor Stackhouse engages across a range of subjects, including theology, ethics, history of Christianity, sociology, missiology, and the philosophy of religion. John is a superb communicator, and alongside his considerable academic and writing prowess, brings a zeal about the faith, which is inspiring and hopeful. One website says this of him: "Our world demands our best, and Dr. Stackhouse helps us to think it and do it."
Blessings flow, blessings flow through our lives.
So I'm delighted in this episode of the Go Health Podcast to be chatting with Professor John Stackhouse. John, welcome to the podcast. I'm really delighted. We're not in the same room, unfortunately. We're doing this via Zoom, which is limiting, but thank God we've got that at least. So John, welcome. We first met a few years ago. We were at a science and religion conference. It was quite a big conference. I didn't know you, but I remember there was this discussion about science and religion, and someone in the room said, "We just, as Christians, need to engage with science. Theology doesn't really matter." They didn't quite say this, but I got the impression that, you know, if you've been to Sunday school once when you were eight, that was enough. You could enter the intellectual battlefield of science and religion. I remember being so incensed. How could somebody say this about this field of theology? I couldn't quite get my words in the right order, and I felt very emotional and cross. And then, John, I remember you stood up and gave this insightful sort of devastating dereliction of their argument in the most kind and humble way. Do you remember that?
I have no recollection at
you
all.
Sorry
about that. I mean, that's apparently a nice moment for you, and I stand up and say things a lot, and I can never remember what I say. So I'm glad it was helpful at the time.
Well, it was brilliant, and it was a great moment for theology, and I've been a fan of your writing ever since. So so John, what do you say you do when these people say, you know, you're having a drink, having coffee? What do? How do you describe your work?
I'm most interested in how religion in general, and particularly Christianity, makes its way in the modern world. How does this religion, founded in the dusty Middle East 2,000 years ago, continue to attract the attention and the devotion of people all over the world in all different cultures and classes, people of very simple outlook, people of very sophisticated outlook? Why is it that Christianity hasn't gone the way of other old-fashioned religions, but in fact continues to grow and continues to apparently meet people's needs? So that's the most interesting thing I study, the most interesting thing I think I get to teach and talk about.
And what's the best way to talk about that? How do you get people's attention? I remember meeting a nun one day, and I was incensed about something or other, and she said to me, "My dear, what you have to remember is no one really cares what the church thinks." And I've also put that in my back pocket and made sure I think about that. How do you engage people in this topic, outside and inside the church?
I think the nun's remark is telling, in that in your country and in mine, Christianity has apparently had its day. And now we're mostly past all that. I mean, we're happy for perhaps some of the nice old buildings, as long as we don't have to pay too much for their upkeep. And we certainly enjoy having lovely music at Christmas and Easter to remind us of our national heritage. But functionally, Christianity is passé and we're on to modern things, is the way lots of people think. So Christianity has a really unusual public relations problem in contemporary Britain, as it does in Canada, in that most people have some sense of Christianity. The polls show us, though, that most people think they know about Christianity is largely wrong, that what they think we believe and what they think we practice is actually a caricature, that they tend to associate us with some of our worst moments, and they tend to misunderstand the best things we have to say. Now, that's really a pretty bad marketing position if you're a company trying to get your message out. And it's high time Christians got hold of this and said, we really do have a message to get out, and we're not doing such a great job of it. So when I start with people, I often will ask them, what do you think being a Christian is? What do you think Christianity actually does have to say? And then try to go from there.
So thinking about the last 12 months and there's the response of the church and Christians to what's going on in our world. So in the UK, if you were to land here and check out the newspapers, the last 12 months, the church has mostly been fighting with itself over whether to open and shut the doors. Yet on the ground, Christians have been with members of many other faith groups responding to the need they see. And there seems to be a real dialectic or division over the two of inside, sort of inside fighting over what to do with this mess we're dealing with and what's happening on the ground. Can you give us a more sort of global picture of how Christians have responded to this pandemic in their own situation, perhaps in Canada or around the world?
Well, certainly in what I sometimes call Greater Britain, you know, the UK, Canada, the US, Australia, New Zealand, the existing division in the church has widened, as often happens, right? When one is under stress, the cracks that are already apparent become even more apparent and often widen under the pressure of the stress. So that churches whose primary way of being in the world is to conduct social service and in the name of Jesus, or perhaps just more generally in the name of God, go about their business under COVID-19 as simply trying to do good in the larger world. Christians and Christian churches that primarily are focused on God, the worship of God, the experience of God, and bringing others toward God, are doubling down at this time and saying, we really need to meet. We really need to continue to do this crucial work of connecting people with God and connecting with each other so that we can have this rich fellowship into which we invite people to meet God and become part of the Christian church. It's really a sad split, of course, Gillian, because the Christian church typically does both. I mean, going back in history and not very far, the Christians would worship and they would care for each other in what we call fellowship, and they would have a mission to the world of charity, yes, but also of evangelism, of trying to win people's attention and draw them toward Jesus Christ. But in the 20th century, that's tended to split, roughly speaking, into sort of liberal and conservative factions. So guess what? They become more and more themselves under the stresses of the coronavirus. Same things happened here in Canada, same things happening in the US, and as I say, in the extension of those kinds of cultures. People become, in a sense, more and more themselves, for better and for worse. And it's too bad because they're both right. Both of these are important parts of what it means to be a Christian, and both of them are responses to COVID-19, with which I have some sympathy.
But if our job is, so if you think about people who are running churches, has there been a dereliction in their duty as pastors, as people who proclaim life beyond death, who would say, if they're Eucharistic, that we understand and are enabled to endure our sufferings because we are part of what happened during Good Friday and Easter Sunday? If we just shut our doors, have we let Christ down? Have we sort of given up our responsibilities to proclaim a deeper kind of healing than simply viral control?
The issues here are several, as you suggest. I think the most basic issue is simply of being treated fairly and equitably. One of the tensions here in Canada is that public health officials have been much more lenient with bars, with pubs, with other public entertainment spaces than they have been with churches. And they've suggested certain public health reasons for that, which most churches don't buy. They aren't, for instance, typically allowing for the fact that church spaces can vary enormously in their size. Putting 60 people in a building that can easily seat 1,000 is not the same as putting 60 people in the building that seats 60. And they aren't making those kinds of distinctions. They're making absolute numbers rather than relative numbers. So the first level is simply equitable treatment. To say, look, we're not asking for special treatment. We're not asking you to give religion some kind of privilege, but we are expecting you not to discriminate against religious gatherings. Just because you don't find them interesting doesn't mean that a significant proportion of the population doesn't find them, in fact, very important to mental health, to social well-being, and indeed to what we think are our religious rights. So that's the first kind of question, and we're still struggling to sort that out here in Canada. Then the second question is the more theological, spiritual one that you get to, which is that some churches, some Protestant churches in particular, have interiorized the faith such that it really is a matter of my mystical and spiritual sense of Jesus and my sense of solidarity with other Christians, but that it doesn't take any particularly material or tangible form. Whereas at the other end of the spectrum, of course, we've got our Roman Catholic friends, Anglo-Catholic friends, and others for whom the material culture, the stuff of the church really matters. It matters to go to church. It matters to take the bread and wine in a service. It matters to be able to kneel at the altar rail and to hear a priest pronounce words of absolution and encouragement. So these are different styles of Christianity, and they're under different, of course, different kinds of stresses here. And I think that, again, it's not for me to tell somebody else, well, you shouldn't worry about that, or you shouldn't be concerned about that. I mean, that's, to me, not particularly civil and certainly not neighborly. If it matters to them, we should, in the name of loving our neighbor as ourselves, try to make whatever accommodation we can for them, even as, of course, we're all in this together and we're trying to prevent the virus from spreading. So, you know, it's hard, but it's also important not to be simplistic, that because it's hard, these are two valid concerns. Keep away and get together can't be easily reconciled.
Yeah. And that's fascinating as well. There's so many tensions in all of this, the tension about wanting to care but not spreading the virus, the tension of wanting the body of Christ, but the body and blood of Christ is itself a contagion. And then the other thing that I found heartbreaking on a gut level, there's so many different levels of suffering, isn't there? People who are dying, people who are ill, people who are at the front line, children, old people. It's loneliness that for some reason really gets me in the gut. And I've been struck just recently, as we begin to think about unlocking, we've been locked down here in the UK since January. As we think about unlocking, we think, what's behind these doors? What have people been locked into? What damage has this loneliness done? Yet, if you think theologically, we're always at a distance from the God who loved and made us. We're always at a distance from our home, if, you know, as we believe as Christians, that we're going on beyond death to something else. In what way can we try to articulate and understand our present situation through the pandemic as just helping us to understand our position anyway in life?
I certainly am not a mental health expert, so I can only speak as a layperson in this regard, but it strikes me that in our own era, particularly, and this is going to take us sideways for a moment, the era of prison reform, there is an increasing awareness of just how punitive solitary confinement, as we call it here, is. When a prisoner, usually because he's misbehaved or occasionally because he's in danger, is isolated from the so-called general population of prisoners and is placed by himself or herself in a single cell. In the Christian history, this was understood to be something so difficult that only the most spiritual of people, the monks, could be locked away in a cell and expect not to lose their minds. This was seen as an extreme form of personal discipline. And it is increasingly seen as an extreme form of punishment in the prison system. So for us to lock down society willy-nilly, I really have almost never heard a public health official connect solitary confinement with what they're expecting of us here. So it seems to me the psychological experts need to talk to each other about this, because there's something, I'm afraid, something really serious that's going on now, that's been going on now for months. A day or two is one thing, but even a week or two in solitary is apparently a significant sort of punishment. How about months on end? At the same time, the great message, I think, of the Christian gospel, as one traces the good news through the Bible, is that God becomes closer and closer to us as the Bible opens. God meets Abram and occasionally meets Abram or Abraham from time to time through his very long life. And then God descends to actually dwell with the nation of Israel in a traveling tent as Israel tents its way from Egypt into the promised land. And then God dwells permanently, so to speak, in the temple that Solomon puts up. And everybody can go see God, go visit God in his house, so to speak. There's the sense in which he's right there, even though, of course, the Israelites understood that God was also in heaven and also above the whole the world. But in the New Testament, we see God becoming a human being and living among us in Jesus. And that's pretty great, because now you can actually see God and listen to God and watch God walk and talk and do things. But then Jesus says to his disciples, I'm going away and something even better is going to happen. And what happens is that Jesus goes to heaven where he rules the world, and he sends the Holy Spirit of God to literally dwell within us. And as one of my friends likes to say, you can't get closer than in. God literally comes to reside within every believer. So there is a sense, and yes, that God seems far away, probably from the general population, but there's also a wonderful message in Christianity that God can be right there, right in your chest, so to speak, right there in your heart, and wants to walk with you. And the Christian way of life, essentially, as the Apostle Paul says, is to keep in step with the Spirit, as if you and the Holy Spirit are hiking friends, as if you're walking chums. And it doesn't mean anything particularly disparaging or silly. It's more like, no, he's the senior partner for sure, but he's setting the pace, he's setting the direction. You can know where to go and where to stop because the Holy Spirit walks with you. This, to me, is a transformative vision of what it's like to live in the world on our way to wherever we're going.
John, I love the way you describe that hiking partner and kind of the indwelling of the Spirit. But just staying with, just pick even further into this, another word that I'm sure you're hearing loads in Canada, and certainly in the UK, our children just went back to school a few weeks ago. And we're looking at the devastation of our economics and all that impact. So the word trauma is around all the time. We've been traumatized by this. We're living through trauma. We can't understand it yet because we're still in the trauma. And if people are suffering with mental health problems and or have been traumatized in the past, then they are then potentially less able to cope with trauma going forward. And I think many of our members and people we work with around the Guild of Health feel, you know, they feel that loneliness, the gut stuff, but also this word trauma, that something has happened to us that's made it hard to cope with, and people respond and are more resilient. So, and there's theories in the Bible, the trauma theory, that the Bible is almost always written by traumatized people. You know, in the Hebrew Bible, you know, whether it was the trauma of the first exile or the trauma of the second exile, and after Jesus died and came back and it all went really different from how they were expecting it, they were then traumatized as well. In what way, where can looking at the biblical text, the foundation of our faith, as a book that deals in trauma, can help us with our present situation?
Those of us like you and me who have had the really wonderful advantage, globally speaking and historically speaking, of a middle-class existence with the ability to earn a professional education and make our way in the world of universities and hospitals and other clean and pleasant and interesting places, have been tempted, as our whole culture has been, really, I think, in Britain since the recovery from the Second World War, which probably didn't really take place till the mid-1960s when paying off the Lend-Lease loans and so on. I lived in Britain myself as a kid in the early 1960s, and my parents remember quite a lot of scarcity, even as late as the early 60s. But since then, with, in many respects, the great recovery of Britain economically and socially, and of course, in Canada, we've had it pretty nicely over these years as well. A friend of mine said, it's only people like you who think that suffering is abnormal. It's only people like you who think that having a difficulty in life somehow needs to be explained or it needs to be dealt with as some unusual occurrence. I mean, take a look at how most of people around the world have lived through most of the centuries of human existence, and you'll find that most people suffer and suffer pretty regularly, such that the rituals of tribal cultural life take suffering into account. When you suffer, not if, when you suffer, here is what you're going to do. When you encounter disease, when you have a child die, when you have suffered an injury in the hunt, when your crops don't grow, this is going to happen, and it is expected to happen. And as you rightly say, lots of people in the Bible have suffering in their past, and most of the New Testament is written by the single individual, the Apostle Paul, who on more than one occasion lists all the terrible things that he has encountered, you know, beatings and shipwreck and fasting or starvation. I mean, over and over again. In the New Testament, the expectation is that Christians are going to suffer, not only because life in the first century in the Roman Empire is no piece of cake, even for the wealthy, but because of their Christian faith, they're going to be routinely going against the grain of their various societies and are going to suffer for it. So there's a sense in which our society properly takes trauma into account and doesn't just say, keep a stiff upper lip or just suck it up, as we say over here, and get on with it. But there's also a sense in which we can overreact and treat each other as really quite helpless cripples who really are barely coping with getting through the day. And most people in the world are getting through the day with far more to deal with than we do.
What's been fascinating here, just going on from what you're saying, is the groups in our world who are saying some version of, now you see what my life's like. The disabled who've never been able to get to church, or people who can't come to church because of mental health problems, or they're saying, well, that's been what I'm going through. And I have to say, in the early days of lockdown, I was reminded strongly of my experience with cancer and the uncertainty around treatment and remission, and does this ever end? I remember the Bishop of London, the last Bishop of London, saying, when I said, mentioned I was in remission, he said, well, Gillian, he said, we're all in remission, really, aren't we? And I remember feeling very, my nose was put out of joint, but he was right, of course. But what's been interesting in sort of the revealing of all these injustices and communities that have been there all the time, but somehow this pandemic has provoked or exposed or revealed, is a good word, like the word apocalypse in the Bible, it's just revelation, it's revealed to us what's been going on all the time. And I'm thinking particularly around minority ethnic groups, Black Lives Matter, and after the killing of George Floyd, that movement that erupted around the world. And people responded to that in different ways. And would you say it's a surprise that these things are coming up at this time? We've got so much going on with the pandemic and respond to that. And suddenly all these other injustices are coming up. Should we be surprised at that? Or is this just what should be happening right now, which some people have termed almost a cultural revolution? It's almost too much to take in.
If you want to know what's inside a cup, then upset it. And I think what we've seen here, this upset that has been prompted by this relentless virus and the public health response to it and the undulation. It seems to be getting, no, it's not getting better, it's getting worse. Now it seems to be a solution. No, that's another 6 months off. Now we're finally getting, no, it doesn't. And so it's not only been the sustained pressures of dealing with it, it's also been the raising and dashing of hopes. And the fury at officials who are letting us down. You see, the Christians shouldn't be surprised by that. I mean, Christians shouldn't be surprised at politicians who screw up. That we shouldn't be surprised that power attracts all sorts of personalities, many of them fairly malignant. We shouldn't be surprised that major companies are much more interested in maximizing return to shareholders than they are at serving the public. I mean, Christians should be among the most realistic of people in the world. So we can be disappointed and we can be sad and we can be angry about injustice, and we should be. And we should be angry about waste, and we should be angry about incompetence, and, you know, vote the rascals out. All of that's perfectly fine, but we shouldn't be surprised. We should expect this kind of behavior from human beings who are at once created in the image of God and thus capable of greatness, of great self-sacrifice. The heroes of this time are genuinely heroic. The people who had been frontline medical people and people who've gone into danger in homes, and especially the larger institutional homes for the elderly and the vulnerable. I mean, God knows, and God will reward these people who have really been willing to pay the ultimate price to care for their fellow human beings. But we're also sinners who are capable of great stupidity as well as great mischief. And we see all of that as well. Again, these stressors are bringing to the surface both the good and the bad. So as you say, it shouldn't surprise us that something like the coronavirus settles like a kind of malign pressure on the landscape and brings to light the fact that we experience the world pretty differently. Life's pretty different when you're a billionaire in one of the high towers of London or Manhattan than it is if you're making your way on the streets below. And in times of stress like this, money is power. Money can get you vaccinated more quickly. Money can get you into the ICU. More quickly, in some, even if, you know, officially you can't. Money lets you eat properly and lets you have clean water and all kinds of things that make the experience very, very different. So it doesn't surprise me then that while we're all, in a sense, stressed anyway and more likely to be reactive, it also isn't just coincidental. In other words, it's not just that we're more sensitive and we're more irritable than we were before. It's literally because this particular kind of stress is bringing to the surface, particularly class difference. And in the United States, that class difference is very tightly connected with racial difference in a way that's not quite so tight, I think, in the UK and in Canada, but it's really more obvious in the States, and especially black-white difference.
In the UK, it's certainly... it's a lot about class, but racism, and racism in the Church of England as well. There's a lot of talk at the moment here about Church of England being a racist institution and demands for some reflection on how power is handled within the church and looking at that. And it's going to be really interesting to see. You've said that after the Second World War, it took a good 20 years before we had the financial impact. Theological impact takes that time as well. I wonder missiologically how long it's going to be for the church to work out what changes need to happen as a result of what we've been going through.
Yes, I think so too. And I think in the Church of England in particular, if I may, the race and theology often connect in the Anglican Communion globally. And so there can be a sense in which the white men who generally run things in Britain may feel that if they appoint too quickly too many black bishops, they're going to find a theological challenge. Because generally, as you know, the Anglican Church in Africa is theologically more conservative and more interested in evangelism and stirring things up that way than the more liberal white establishment would be back in Britain, and indeed as it is also here in Canada and the US.
I did an event recently, John. It was called Questions of Our Time. It wasn't a COVID event, but what did they want to do is get people just to talk about what they decided was the questions of our time. And my one was on health. And so I was asked the question that they believed was a question of the time, which was, why did God send the virus? I have to say I'm bored of answering that question and explaining why that's a bad question and then going on to talk about a better question. But also really worried me because I don't think that's a question of our time in matters of church and health. And I wondered what you thought was, what is a question of our time for people of faith?
Well, I'm intrigued to know why you don't think that's a question of our time. So tell me.
Well, I think it's an important question to answer because we can talk about suffering. We can talk about how we can live in a world where that God created, how we understand God to love us and care for us, and yet rubbish happens like coronavirus and cancer and death. We can talk, and there's lots of good answers to that. There's lots of bad answers, but there's good answers too. And then we can chat about that. Now, I had a problem with that question because I run a health and faith organization. This is my bread and butter day and night. No one has asked me that question as a faith, you know, they're not asking me that. And I'm saying, your church leaders on the ground, your Christians on the ground, my charity is here to resource you and support you in doing your work. And what do you need? No one's asking me to help them answer that question. They're asking me for other things. So I think the question of our time is around alienation and shame. And I think people are saying, am I good enough? Am I worth it? It's a lot of isolation, which is isolated. So the Ministry of Reconciliation back in the day, as they say in North London, was all about getting to heaven. I don't think the Ministry of Reconciliation is about that so much anymore. It's a powerful ministry, but it's a ministry helping people see that they're really worth it. In order to go on and do the work of a Christian.
Oh, good. Well, I'm glad I asked. That's a good answer. That was certainly better than anything I was going to say. So that's great. Well, I really do think that one of the big questions here that people probably ask within the church and without is what is the church's response to this and what ought it to be? Is the church truly going to attend only to its own business as it sees it? Is the Christian church just another special interest group among all others, a club that enjoys its own membership and its own activities and generally wants to be left alone, thank you, but certainly wants the occasional privilege? Or is it, in fact, what I think it's always been, which is fundamentally a service organization? Now, I don't want to be misunderstood. Fundamentally, human beings worship God, yes, but we also are called by God to love each other as our neighbors and to care for the planet as those who are the gardeners of the world. And the Christian church is no different. That's what we're supposed to be. We're supposed to be properly functioning human beings who love God and care for each other and also in an exemplary way care for the rest of the planet. And the only special thing about churches and Christians is that we have the message, as you say, of reconciliation, that the way to get reconnected to God, as far as we know, the best way is to come to meet Jesus Christ through the Holy Spirit, to be taught by the Bible. And this is the best way God has made available to us to get back on track, so to speak, is to get back online with God and to reconnect with God so you can be a properly functioning human being. Well, if, in fact, the Christian message is not just join the coolest religion in the world, because Christianity is a particularly cool religion, if, in fact, the message is to become right with God and live a properly led life, then Christians jolly well ought to be living a properly led life. They ought to be looking like exemplary citizens, people who other people would like to be like. People who are unusually kind, unusually charitable, unusually serious about maintaining good relationships and repairing bad ones and trying to help us live as healthy human beings in healthy relationships with healthy lifestyles. It's all about life. And if Christians are manifesting a healthy life, well, who doesn't want more of that? But if we're not, then we don't really care what else you're saying. I mean, to me, the New Testament is just about as stark as that. You're either walking in the path of life or you're walking in some other path, which I frankly don't care about.
In your latest book, Can I Believe? What was the subtitle for that book? Can I Believe?
Christianity for the Hesitant.
I really recommend this book. I wear a dog collar, so you could say I'm a professional Christian. I'm kind of convinced of it, but I learned so much from the book. And one of the things I got so powerfully in the book is you make the case for Christianity, you pose good questions, and you give great answers, is that we've always been a faith which is going out and making other Christians in a deliberate way about growth. And certainly in the UK, the economic growth model of the church has been very popular with certain movements within the church. But I was really struck about, you know, that we've, and I've been very critical of this economic growth culture in the church. It's all about growth. And what that does is just stress people out, and we need to be all caring and loving. But when I read your book, I was like, well, no, this is much more important than just, you know, the bishop's latest mission action plan. This is what we've always been about. And I wonder if there's any special opportunities right now as we continue to move through the pandemic. We're not quite out of it yet, but we've done a year now. Are there opportunities for the Christian faith at this time for growth, given the amount of suffering and trauma that we're dealing with?
In Canada, if you ask most of my fellow Canadian citizens, when you think of Christianity, when you hear Christian church pop up in the media, what comes to mind? What do you immediately associate with Christianity? Here, I suspect, although I don't know, I'd like to see a pollster actually test my theory. The number one answer is going to be the so-called residential schools. These were the boarding schools that were erected in the 19th and 20th centuries, especially in Western Canada, for the far-flung populations of settlers on our huge expanse of prairie. And these are white kids, but a lot of them were indigenous or native kids as well. And the native kids were meant to be assimilated. The slogan was to kill the Indian in the child and to make them basically as white as possible, as quickly as possible. And there were mixed motives here. Some of them, I think, were actually good. Some of them were clearly bad. Some of these were sites of terrific abuse. Others were simply the kind of cultural imperialism that would have been typical of white people around the world in the 19th century. No big deal in terms of being startling, but certainly a big deal for those on the receiving end of that kind of cultural imperialism. So this has come to the fore in a recent Truth and Reconciliation Commission that was launched across Canada about a decade ago. So 10 years downstream of that TRC, if you ask Canadians, what do you think about when you think about the Christian churches? A lot of people, the first thing out of their mouths is going to be, well, you hate native peoples. You know, you're racists. And if you're not that, you're homophobes. And if you're not that, you don't like women. So as I say, there's some pretty big negative marks here. And then if you ask people some more, is there anything else you know about Christianity? Well, let's see. Anything good, maybe? Yeah. Salvation Army, like them. Yeah, we like them. World Vision, I've heard of them. They're pretty good. Mother Teresa, yep, she's pretty great. Now, the list may not get much longer, but at least there's that. And as I recently found myself saying in the Canadian media, this is where Christians need to simply act like Christians. This is not putting something on. This is not a masquerade. This is not some kind of cynical ploy to get people into our churches. We're going to pretend to be nice, and then they'll join our churches. See, it's only really clergy that benefit from any of this anyway, because they at least get their salaries paid by the church. The rest of us, there's no motive in my making converts. I mean, I don't get any kind of per capita payment for every scalp that I bring in, for every person I get to church. It's like the world's worst Ponzi scheme where almost nobody gets any money at all. It's all about sharing life. Like, if I care about you, Jillian, I want to tell you about my favorite restaurant. I want to tell you about my favorite new music. And I sure want to tell you about this new diet and this new exercise program in which I've lost 30 pounds and I've gained energy and I sleep better. Like, that's what people sound like when they have discovered something that has changed their lives for the better. And that's what Christians should sound like when they talk about meeting Jesus.
Yeah. It's the whole life approach. I think in this country, our church, like in Canada, has got huge problems. Our problems at the moment are all about sex and child abuse and issues of power. It's just endemic, and that's what people think. I mean, I've been on the street in a procession of clergy, can you imagine? And, you know, people just shouting paedophiles at the male priests, and that's it every day. Or if I'm wearing a dog collar, I feel like I need to say, "Hi, I'm Gillian. You know, I've got gay friends." You know, and it's just because I'm just working with the assumptions that my assumptions about their assumptions, which is awful. So huge problems here too, and certainly cultural Christianity, where, you know, you go to church on Sunday because that's what one does, as opposed to affecting. And I remember in one of your books, I think it's Need to Know, this idea that, you know, everything you do in life, you do as a Christian. And for some reason, that phrase, how do you mow the lawn? Do you mow the lawn as a Christian? But that's always in my head, you know, because it should affect us on such a deep level if it's going to mean anything at all. And that book as well that I was going to mention, Need to Know, it's that phrase, vocational epistemology, which is very fancy and churchy kind of term. That's sort of translated into normal person speak is God will give us what we need to do the things we need to do. If I was going to get a tattoo, that would be what it was. I'm not going to get a tattoo. But I mean, that's a translation, vocational epistemology. God will give us what we need to do the things we need to do. So there's so much in that, you know, that we all have our own jobs. There's something God wants us to do. And I think that's so powerful, especially in the healing ministry, where sometimes people think it's about making people better, where I talk about the healing ministry is, you know, healing is just about living, how to live well and what we do. And so when you're working with people who are ill, they're not people to be healed. They're people with something to do that's known and loved and valued by God. So God will give us what we need to do the things we need to do. What do we need to do right now as Christians?
I think we need to recover our priorities and set them in proper order. I think that it is natural to focus on where you hurt, right? It's natural to focus on where you're currently experiencing some kind of deficit. But if you're not careful, that becomes your whole world. And you, as a medical practitioner, as well as a clergy person, recognize, I'm sure, better than I do, that it's a bad thing to focus too much on your injury or on your disease. It is taking some good things from you. Don't give it more than it's already going to take. Don't give it more attention than it's already going to take. Don't give it more of your emotion than it's already going to demand. And instead, make sure that you resist the urge to be sucked into this black hole of pain and unhappiness and live the rest of your life. My wife had a spinal injury 5 or 6 years ago, from which she's only been able to make a partial recovery with surgery. She is in chronic pain. She had to leave her practice of physiotherapy for a desk job in healthcare administration. She misses very much the hands-on practice of physiotherapy. And I feel very badly for her because I don't wrestle with chronic pain. And I talk to her every night, how she's doing. And she mostly doesn't want to talk about it, not because she doesn't appreciate my sympathy, but because she doesn't want that to be the conversation. This is just part of her life and she's accepted it as part of it. And let's talk about everything else. Not because she, you know, on particularly bad days, great. I can rub her neck. I can bring her a blanket. I can bring her a heating pad. Great. But otherwise, she said, this is my life now. And as a physio, she knows she's probably not going to get much better. Arthritis is probably going to make it worse. So let's not make life about that. And so I think the Christian church, which has a big horizon, which sees, as you said earlier, beyond this life to a wonderful world to come, and that sees everything that we experience in this life as meaningfully directed toward preparing us and preparing each other for enjoying that life to come. That's a much better frame of reference, of course, that keeps me from being unhealthily preoccupied with my genuine suffering and instead says, yeah, let's take it in stride. Let's take it seriously, but not too seriously. right? Let's deal with it, but let's not let it become the idol, the center, the focus, the God of my life. It's just this. And the Christian church is always against idols. It's always against putting anything in the center of your life except God and God's good ways. If the church is about nothing else, it needs to be about reminding us about what really matters most.
That's a powerful message for those who are ill, those who are in pain, those whose life is not what they thought it would be, and have to work out a way to live with that. But I also found your words really powerful from the other side, because often when people are suffering or ill or in pain, to the medical world, they are their injury or their illness. And that is a sort of a humiliating and a difficult position to be in. And I certainly experienced that when I was ill, that I was that blue folder of notes. I was my latest scan. I was a whole bunch of words I didn't understand that I couldn't translate. I had to Google. And I didn't know at the time because I was young, but I was really angry. I didn't know it at the time because my whole person wasn't there. Now, for very good reasons, the doctors were treating the naughty cancer cells so I could get better. And that's good. And thank God for medical science. But just knowing, I think, just being able to hang on. Sometimes we can really grasp it and grasp the knowledge and depth of love of God and what we're doing. Sometimes you've only got a fingernail on that and you're just hanging on. But hanging on to that can also empower us, I think, when we're going through difficult circuits, that we're not just whatever rubbish has happened to throw at us.
Well, I was going to say that's really helpful for you to bring that experience of yours as an educated patient into that. And certainly my wife has talked about that too, that they will literally refer as medical professionals to the total hip in room 231. Wow. The fracture in room 562. Like they literally talk that way quite routinely, at least here in Canada and the United States. And it strikes me, perhaps with fresh force, that this is one of the reasons why hospital chaplains are so helpful and why the visits of both clergy and of regular folk to patients in hospital has an extra special benefit, because we do relate to you as a patient, as you, because we frankly don't know very much about medicine. So a total hip doesn't mean much to us. A fracture is something we've read about in school, but you are Jillian. You are our friend. You could be our mother or our sister or our churchmate. And it restores one's sense of being other than this anonymous draped lump in an anonymous draped bed that is being poked and prodded as if you're a specimen in a lab. And that's how you can feel in a hospital quite routinely, that you're in this gigantic laboratory and you're one of about 100 or so specimens that are being treated and fixed and then sent out into the world. There can be a profound loneliness in a hospital when you're surrounded by dozens of people, but you are really an island as a person. And for people to keep coming in, and I think this is something in COVID that's so important, to come into people's hospital rooms, to come into their homes with all the appropriate public health protocols observed, but to say, I still see you. I still hear you. You're still there. You're not vanishing. You're not unimportant. And I still embrace you as best I can as somebody of lingering importance. I think the loneliness that you describe is part of it is a sense of I'm disappearing. I'm not mattering anymore. And for people to come back and say, yes, you do matter. You matter enough that I've taken time in my day to come and see you or to call you or to make a Zoom arrangement with you. I think this is more important than we have really even now properly understood.
Sometimes I talk about pastoral ministry. If I'm teaching, I'll just draw a cup of tea. It's in England, right? So we love our tea. And during the pandemic, I've been speaking to as many pastors as I can as we develop our projects here in the Guild, ask them, what do they need? And one of them said to me, you know what I need, Jillian? I need a resource that I can hand to my parishioners to help them say, how are you, to someone, and listen to the answer. Because right now, there is so much suffering. And you just, I haven't spoken to you for years, John, and you kind of, what do? You say, how are you? Well, like, how do you answer that in a pandemic? And right now, the power of ordinary Christians on the street saying, "How are you?" and listening to the answer could be profoundly healing.
Well, this is, to me, one of the great contributions that Asia and then Britain has given to the world, is the cup of tea. Because you can't just go to the fridge and produce a cup of tea the way we North Americans can go to the fridge and produce a soft drink, you know, a soda pop, as we say, or a glass of milk or a beer, that you've got to fuss with the tea. It takes a while. And while you're doing that, you are bonding over the trivialities, but also the regularities, the sense of normality that comes, that whatever crisis we're about to talk about that has prompted us to get together, it's rooted in the real world, and certain things will keep happening, like tea. And I thought you were gonna make, I think, this wonderful line that the, you know, the pastor says to you, or the priest says to you, you know, "I need something from you that I can give to my give them a cup of tea." That's the big technology that you can be given by the Guild of Health. Give them a cup of tea, and all that comes with it, because what comes with it is going to be fellowship, is going to be recognition, is going to be humanity. Do that, and you'll be blessing people in ways that the medical establishment's not set up to give them, and that the public health establishment is not set up to give them.
So I've got a new marketing idea. I'm going to have Guild of Health tea bags straight away. I'll make it.
Yeah.
So finally, that's my final question, John. I could chat all day. So here we are. We're recording this in March 2021. This should come out in May 2021. We've had the anniversary. And things look a lot rosier. We've got the vaccine here in the UK, and, you know, spring bulbs are coming up, all that. But there is a lot of uncertainty that lies ahead, you know, and the tabloid newspapers are, you know, now making their bread and butter on the uncertainty that lies ahead. In what or where do you place your hope at this time, looking ahead, for Christians who might be listening?
I think that the virus and its implications have been with us long enough now that we are not going to snap back to March 2020, right? I think most of us at some level recognize that, however much we want things to go back to the way they were. If we led a reasonably comfortable and happy life in March 2020, we want things to go back the way they were. Lots of people didn't. So they're hoping we don't. And they're rightly hoping we don't, because it wasn't all that great in March 2020 before the virus hit. It wasn't all that great for Black people or poor people. It wasn't that great for kids enduring child poverty, right? There's a lot of people for whom it'd be great if things weren't the same way. Thanks very much. So the rush to return to so-called normalcy, it would be really sad if we wasted the year of suffering only to put things back to the way they were, because they weren't that great back then. So I think the opportunity is to survey the devastation of small businesses, the devastation of many people's employment, the devastation of especially the fun parts of our economy, right? Restaurants and theaters and plays, but these aren't just fun. A lot of this is art and serious vocations for people. One of my sons lives and works in New York City and works in the Broadway world. And it's just been terrifying what's happened to people's careers. I mean, they've lost a whole year, and some people may never recover. So there's a lot we have yet to even fully grasp as to what's happened. It's a little bit like we're coming out of our houses after a major earthquake, and we have to see what's still standing and what isn't, and where fires are still burning that need to be put out right away, and where other places have burned out, but they burned out and there's not going to be any rebuilding. People are going to have to go somewhere else. So it's going to be a long time to figure this out. And what can the church do? Well, the church should do what the church does best and encourage other people to do what they do best, rather than the church trying to do everything and doing a bunch of things badly, right? So this is where I think we need to say, what does the church do best? The church reminds us of God. The church reminds us of the big picture. The church then acts as God's agent in the world of love and care and of personal solidarity. The church has financial resources which it needs to bring to bear to care for those who are most needy, not just to pry, not just to repair itself, not just to try to put things back to where they were in March 2020, but to try to say, you know, maybe in the light of this, we don't need as many X's, Y's, and Z's as we thought. Maybe we can liquidate some of that and actually put that in the hands of people who need it more. Maybe in the name of Jesus, we need to reestablish some different priorities. So there is a, you know, it's now become a glib phrase, don't waste a good crisis, but it would be a shame if we did waste this one and instead come back to doing what the church should always have done best and what the church needs to do centrally, which is to love people in the name of the God who really does love us.
And are you hopeful, John, that the church can, I mean, the church is run by people, right? But, you know, there's authorities and structures and so on in that. How optimistic are you that this might happen? The people will 100 years from now look back and say, this was the moment that are we looking at a reformation? Do you think?
No, I don't think that, because I don't think that people are interpreting the virus in a particularly religious or theological or ecclesiastical way. So it would be extraordinary for them to transfer the register from a kind of a public health crisis to a kind of religious crisis. But Jillian, I'm never optimistic, but I always try to be hopeful. I'm a historian, and I've got a fairly dim view about human capacity, but it's not dark. It's just dim. We are, as a group, we do tend to stumble a lot, and we are certainly vexed with mixed motives. But lots of people, from really prominent heroes to everyday heroic folk, are capable of greatness. We are capable of tremendous love in the image of the God who made us. In many respects, I hope our leaders will, in a sense, get out of our way and let people be the good that they can be and maybe facilitate that from time to time. That's all I hope for. Just kind of get out of the way. Don't make things worse. And then maybe at least encourage those who are doing something good. It's not going to get all better. It's not utopia. On the other hand, it has the virus has laid bare realities with which we have an opportunity now to deal before they get submerged into the new normal. I hope we'll grasp this opportunity.
Professor John Stackhouse, thank you so much for giving us your time for the Go Health podcast and for helping us look at these questions that COVID has brought for Christians and church leaders everywhere.
Great to talk to you, Jillian.
You have been listening to the Go Health podcast. Our theme music is from the song River of Life by Lofter. To continue the conversation and to find out more about the Go Health community, go to our website, gohealth.org.uk, and find us also on Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram. And there, join in the conversation, because together we flourish. In the